creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
This week on Culture Click, we hear from Colette Hyman, a professor of history from Winona State University, about six generations of the art of Dakota women. Hyman talks about the quill work, beadwork, and painting Dakota women would do to everyday objects to embellish and beautify them. This decorating was known as fancy work, and many Dakota descendants are continuing that work today.
About 8 years ago, I was casting about for a research project, and I wanted to do something local. I didn't want to have to travel very much, and I thought I would start researching the history of women in southern Minnesota and in Winona. And of course, I realized that I needed to know something about the history of the indigenous peoples of this part of the world. And lo and behold, I realized that nothing had been written, very little had been written about the Dakota, who were the indigenous peoples of this part of Minnesota, and even less about women. So I set out with very little experience in the field of Native history. But I was warmly welcomed, and a lot of Dakota people have shared their stories, have shared their photos, and have shared artifacts with me. And one of the things that I knew, though, novice as I was in the field of Native history, is that the conventional documents that we use in the study of history, paper texts and books, really are largely non-existent, particularly if we want to get the Dakota people's perspective, Native people's perspective on their history. So we have to use other kinds of sources. And one of the sources that Dakota people themselves talk about as being important are oral accounts. And I have certainly used those. And I was aware that there were these collections of artifacts in museums, and I wanted to see what I could make of those, even though I had no training or experience in working with artifacts. I took a couple of classes. I did some museum work when I was in college, but that was long ago now. But I sallied forth into the world of museums and artifacts, and in the fall of 2005, I went to the Smithsonian Institution. What makes these artifacts really hard to use for historians, and probably why historians don't use them very much, is that for the most part, they are unidentifiable. At best, what we know is who collected these, what white person gathered them and deposited them, donated them, or sold them to whatever museum it was. I was extremely excited then to find this collection of dolls at the Smithsonian, two of which I have photos of here. So this is the front. That's the woman. This is the man. And these dolls were part of a collection that was meticulously cataloged and identified. It had been put together by a woman named Betty Meagers, who was an anthropologist, who wrote letters to Bureau of Indian Affairs agencies on reservations asking for if anybody had dolls to sell for her collection. And she wrote one of these letters to the Winnebago Agency in Winnebago, Nebraska. She wrote it to the Indian agent there, who must have passed it along to a teacher at the school on the reservation, because she then replied to Betty Meager saying, yes, I have a pair of dolls. They were just brought to the agency for selling by a woman named Mary Mitchell. She just died. She was from the Santee Reservation, and the Santee Reservation is one of the two that I had been doing research on. So there are these dolls, and they're identified as being the work of a particular woman who happens to be from the reservation that I was getting to know pretty well. And the following summer, when I went there for my close to annual research trips, interviewing and learning about the community and learning about the landscape, I learned that Mary Mitchell, the woman who'd made these dolls, was the grandmother of a woman named Isla Mackey, whom I had met the previous summer. I took these photos, I took this information when I went to interview Mrs. Mackey, and she said, oh yeah, I know who that is, that's my grandmother Mary. And she took out all sorts of photos, and she and her daughter and son had done all sorts of family research, and I couldn't be doing what I'm doing today without this happy coincidence that it was the granddaughter of the woman who made these dolls, whom I had planned to spend time with and interview anyway. And after my trip to Santee, I went to Flandreau, which is the other reservation I've been studying, and that's in South Dakota. That's about 10 miles west of Pipestone, Minnesota, another Dakota, Eastern Dakota community. I'll talk more about them a little bit later. And it happens that at Flandreau, I had a good friend that I'd met at the very beginning of this research, a woman named Myrna Weston, who is a quill work artist. And Myrna, it turns out, was Isla Mackey's niece, which made Myrna the great-granddaughter of Mary Mitchell, who made these dolls. At Flandreau, I'd also met, Myrna had introduced me to her brother Everett and to her cousin Kenny James, and Kenny had introduced me to his sister Margaret Daniels. So I know a lot of members of this family, the descendants of the woman who made this doll. And because this family is very interested in its history, they've gathered information about generations before her. So I know now six generations, information on six generations of these women. And through that family, I can trace the history of the Dakota people, the history of Dakota women, and also the history of Dakota women's fancy work. And I use that term because that's the term that Dakota women and other Native women use to talk about this kind of work. Most Native languages don't have a word for art. They do produce, create what we and I in my work talk about as art, but when we think about art, we think of things on the wall or things on pedestals that are made for admiring and for taking inspiration from, but certainly not for using. So fancy work acknowledges the art that goes into creation, but also the fact that these objects are not made to just admire, but are made to use and are part of everyday life. And through Mary and the generations of women in her family, we can trace the evolution of women's artistic work. In looking at this work, it becomes clear that while the materials and functions and circumstances of this artwork and its creation changed dramatically over a century and a half, this work nevertheless continues to embody and represent Dakota women's identity. Through both the designs and the work itself, Mary and the other women in her family express some fundamental dimensions of their Dakota identity and at the same time define some of the features of that identity. So, Mary's grandmother was a woman named Wichachika, which means like a man, because the story in the family is that after the Dakota had been exiled from Minnesota after the 1862 war, she walked back to Minnesota from Nebraska to find some lost family members and then walked back from Minnesota across rivers and prairies back to the Santee Reservation like a man would have, and she was given the name Wichachika. She was born in 1808 and she grew up, she came to adulthood in Minnesota at a time when the Dakota still were able to retain a considerable amount of power vis-a-vis Europeans and therefore retained much of their traditional ways of living and sustaining themselves and their communities. And for women, this included making their families' clothing, the containers they used for their food and their equipment, making other household equipment by preparing hides and sewing them. And women received the highest praise for the ornamentation that they added to moccasins, to parfleches, which are large hide containers, to knife cases, to something they called strike pouches, which would originally have been pouches that women and men carried with flints to make fire. But Myrna, the great-granddaughter of Mary, who's my friend, talks about her grandmother carrying a strike pouch. It wasn't a flint, of course, that she carried. It was matches. It was a Kleenex. It was coins. But she still called it a strike pouch. And this was part of what women made in order to carry on their daily life and in order to participate in ceremonies. One of the missionaries who spent decades living among the Dakota wrote about them, and he wrote in particular, and here I'm quoting him, this is Samuel Pond, "The dress moccasins of the men were garnished with porcupine quills, beads, and ribbons, and many other articles of attire were also elaborately decorated by the women." Now, he kind of casually refers to this decorating work that women did, that it's beautiful and it's part of ceremonial attire and other garments that men wore. But in fact, this became a very substantial part of the life and work of these women. The materials used in making these items had to be gathered and prepared, or in the case of silk ribbons, for instance, bought from traders. And much of this work was the responsibility of women. As hides were the mainstay of women's production of clothing, containers, teepees, and other objects, processing them so that they were of the desired color and texture constituted a critical first step in the production process. Now, sometimes men participated in making hides and tanning the hides, but women were at the very least responsible for drying and smoking the hides after that. And this is a painting by a man named Seth Eastman, who was a captain in the U.S. Army, who was also a painter, and he documented much of the life of the Dakota. And this is obviously not an image that I can use for publication, but it shows here the woman at work scraping, and here already she's wearing European cloth clothes. This looks like a metal scraper. Before contact with Europeans, she would have been using a scraper made out of buffalo bone. And she's probably using in here a mixture that uses, among other things, buffalo fat and buffalo brains to make the hide nice and flexible. Women used beads to decorate, and they came into women's repertoire pretty quickly after the initial contact with European traders. But women continued also to use porcupine quills as central to decorating these objects. They used them on shirts, dresses, robes, moccasins, cradles. And women, this was also a pretty labor-intensive work. You had to get the porcupine, although that was primarily the men's job. You had to get the quills off of the skin. You had to sort them by size, wash them, dye them, and dye them with dyes that had been prepared with plants that women had gathered and had prepared themselves, right? And once the quills were dyed, they needed to be softened, and women chewed on them, and then they just kind of flattened them through their teeth. And then they were ready to do the quill work, which they often did in images, in designs that were floral and curlicued as a characteristic of the more woodland Indians. In one phase of the work or another, creating art through quill work, painting, or beadwork made up a substantial part of the lives of Dakota women. Once the materials were gathered and prepared, the work of decorating itself began and would be accomplished in between tending to other responsibilities. Creating art was thoroughly interwoven into the daily and seasonal activities of Dakota women, and making art by embellishing objects for daily use was part of what distinguished women from men among the Dakota. Now, as I said already, there's no word for art in many native languages, but making art, making beautiful objects, beautifying functional objects was integral to many native cultures. And in an article called Growing Up Indian, Tom Hill, who's a member of the Seneca Nation, and Richard Hill Sr., who's a member of the Tuscarora Nation, try to write about this dimension of native culture. Try to imagine, they write, what it was like to grow up in a time when making things was a never-ending part of daily life. Household goods, hunting equipment, clothing, and religious objects were produced within the community. Every day included artistic creation and spiritual expression. Children were surrounded by artists. So Wichachaka grew up and came to adulthood in this kind of community, and bore her daughter Emma in this kind of community, and used these decorated objects, and probably carried Emma in a basket like this one, in a cradle board like this one, which could be leaned up against a tree. It could also be hung from a branch. It could also be tied to a horse if there was traveling that was necessary, and carried on a woman's back. Very few of these remain intact, and this is one of the very few that exists in museum collections that is all of the original materials, including the wood board. This was collected by a man named George Catlin, who accumulated a huge collection of artifacts and who painted the lives of Native people in the Northern Plains and the Dakotas. And I actually got to hold this cradle when I was at the Smithsonian. It's probably about 10 pounds without the baby, which makes it sturdy to hang from a tree or from a horse, but it's also quite bulky. So, back to my story, one can imagine that Mary Mitchell's mother, Emma, was carried around by her mother, Wichachaka, in this kind of cradle. We can also imagine that Wichachaka and the women in her community would make a pouch like this. And this is an example of that quill work. These bird-like beings here represent the thunder beings of the Dakota cosmology, the Wakinyan, the spirits of the skies that have great power among the Dakota. But what you have here are cones that tinkle. They're usually called tinkle cones. And these were made out of metal, probably metal from tools that the Dakota would have bought from traders, so tools made in Europe that they would have flattened and cut into and made into these cones. You see there are slits in the pouch that allowed it to be hung from a belt or from a horse pack or from a strap inside a teepee so that it could be multi-purpose. Another item, this is a knife sheath, and more of this kind of quill work. And you'll see here that not only is there metal that would have come from trade goods, but this is the remains of a ribbon that also would have been acquired from traders. So women integrated into their work materials that they got from Europeans living among them. Here we see it in a little more detail. So each of these triangles here is a piece of quill, and they would be wrapped around or stitched into a piece of hide. And after they'd been dyed, we see a little bit of remaining quills here. We get a sense of how they're wrapped around the item. This is also, some of these are quills wrapped around these straps here. Sometimes feathers would be used, bones, shells, to ornament these items. This is a couple of pairs of mittens, and I include these here because they have the more characteristic floral design, or design that would become more characteristic of the Eastern Dakota later on in the 19th century.
We go now to our interview with Colette after her talk. You're listening to KQAL, and I'm sitting down with Colette Hyman, who just gave a presentation on six generations of Dakota art. So can you introduce yourself, what your position is, and then I guess a brief synopsis of what your presentation was on?
Well, my name is Colette Hyman. I am a professor of history here at Winona State University, and I have been working since 2002 on research about the history of Dakota women, and the Dakota, of course, are the people indigenous to this part of Minnesota and the upper Mississippi River Valley. And my talk today focuses on the work of six generations of Dakota women, focusing on their beadwork and quill work.
So, you know, we think of art maybe in a Western kind of sense, like it's an elite kind of thing, you know, and it's meant to be on a pedestal, on the wall, in a gallery. And then the fancy work that the Dakota people do is more functional. That's shifted, though, hasn't it? Now it's more decorative.
Right. So originally it was functional, not necessarily for everyday use. There would be objects that would have particularly ornate beadwork that might be reserved for special ceremonies. But still, since women made a lot of the tools and a lot of the carrying cases of various sorts that were used in everyday life, they probably put some marks on them to distinguish them as their own work or to make them somewhat special. And this was used in the community. Women made them for each other, for the birth, for an important event in a family. Again, for use internally within the community. Very quickly, though, women realized, and men in these Dakota and other Native communities, that white people were interested. Starting in the late 19th century, late 18th century, white people began collecting these objects, and women started creating them, producing them specifically for sale. And when the Dakota were exiled from Minnesota and placed on reservations, when other Native people were restricted also to reservations with very few income-generating activities, the women would turn to this artwork that they knew they could sell to white people off reservation. And this would provide for their family's budget, for their family's subsistence.
Do you think it lost any of its cultural significance when it shifted from the functional to the kind of commercial marketable kind of thing? I mean, selling their products for, not just making it for themselves, but making it for someone else, did that change at all? Or did that change its significance?
It certainly changed the significance. And as my friend Myrna Weston, who is a quill worker today, she talks about making different things when she's selling them for consumption, for sale outside of her community. She makes those in particular designs that have particular colors, for instance, that she knows she can sell. And she makes things at various for various income levels. Earrings she makes that are pretty affordable in the $20 to $30 range. She also makes much more elaborate, for instance. But when she's making, she also makes objects to mark the birth of a child, or she's asked to make something for a high school or a college graduation, or for somebody who's returning from military service. And that she only does for barter. She does as part of contributing to her community. And so I think that there are different consciousnesses that come in different kind of production, and I don't think either is less authentic or indigenous, but it marks the different ways in which this art occurs, exists, is perpetuated in Native communities.
Right, so it's just like an evolution. This is just another
absolutely
step to
yes.
It. Can you describe some of the designs that they do? Are their designs more decorative, or are they narrative, or are they both?
Oh, that's a really good question. The designs that women do with these beads and quills are decorative. There are examples, but I'm not sure they're Eastern Dakota, of more narrative painting done on hides. Later, starting in the late 19th century, you have something called ledger art, where men in particular, what's been preserved is the work of men, at boarding schools would have access to ledger paper and would use that to draw stories of their lives, their families' lives, traditions from their culture, stories of creation, and those are more narrative. And those might be more particular to the Western Dakota. I have not come across any of that in the Eastern Dakota, the peoples who lived in Minnesota and who were removed in after 1862.
And what about colors? Are there certain colors that were primarily with Eastern Dakota, or is it just the availability of things?
I think it's more the availability. The Lakota favor light blue and have different meanings for different colors. The Eastern Dakota suffered such horrible dislocation and devastation and catastrophe after 1861, being moved to lands far from where they'd lived, the experience at Crow Creek, the experience at Davenport, the military devastation were, I think, beyond what we can imagine. And not only did these cause death and death at Crow Creek, but a cultural dying off. Not entirely, of course. The women and children and the elders at Crow Creek barely survived. And one of the things that they were not able to do is make this work. Do this work, make this art, and I think that that's part of the spiritual assault on the Dakota and what they had to reconstitute when the Dakota were reunited on the Santee Reservation and then on the Flandreau Reservation that they started was to restart not only physically their families, their community, but restart, reignite their traditions, their culture that had been very directly assaulted by the military, by federal civilian officials, by missionaries. Other Dakota people say in western South Dakota on the Rosebud and Pine Ridge reservations were much larger communities, did not experience quite the same level of assault, and were able to perpetuate much more of their traditions. And in fact, a lot of the people from Flandreau and Santee have traveled to Rosebud, to Pine Ridge, to relearn some of the traditions, to bring them back. And this is in the last 20 or 30 years. So the questions you're asking me about color, about design, that knowledge, I think, has been lost, as a lot of knowledge has been lost.
And I mean, you said a lot of the information that you had to collect was by oral kind of conversation. Do you think it's going to continue to be lost, the further generations?
There are numbers of Dakota people who are working very hard to maintain their culture at the Santee Reservation. There are efforts at gathering the oral histories of the elders. There is a language immersion program, because the one kind of knowledge that's being lost is the indigenous language. And this is all across the continent. Mm-hmm. And there are efforts in just about every community, many of these indigenous communities, to revitalize their languages as part of maintaining the culture and revitalizing the culture. And all these things go hand in hand, the decline in use of the language, the decline in knowledge of other kinds of traditions, and there are efforts underway to reclaim them.
How far back can we go? Are we only able to go back 6 generations?
Well, that's in the family that
you found.
I've gotten mm-hmm. to know. That's about, though, as far back. One of my friends, Diane Wilson, wrote a book called Spirit Car, where she traces her own family. And she's able to go about as far back to the generation or two before the 1862 war. Before that, really, memory dims, and also you have the war, which really cut, really chopped the community up. I talked in my talk about how some went to Canada and some went farther west, and some were hanged and some died and some chose to assimilate. And that war, for every Dakota person I've talked to, is a point of demarcation in their family's history and their personal history. And in part, one of the consequences of that war is the loss of a lot of knowledge. So some of the traditions that I was talking about earlier, but I think knowledge about family. And that what we know, what I've been able to learn, what Mary Mitchell's descendants have been able to learn, what Diane Wilson has been able to learn, is only as far back as the memory of those surviving 1862 could go. So there is that limit. Now, there are other sources for learning about Dakota people and other Native people. One of the resources I've used are the records kept by traders. So they are organized by the individual, and we learned what they bought, what each individual bought, and how they paid for it, in pelts, in hides, in cash. And that's extremely interesting. And sometimes the trader will write, well, this is, you know, Bad Hail, and so that's Bad Hail's nephew, and that's Bad Hail's wife. And so, you know, we can retrace some of those families. But that's very fragmentary.
Thank you to Colette Hyman for her talk on the art of Dakota women. Tune in next Thursday afternoon at 12:30 for part two, where Colette talks about the Dakota tribe's relocation and life on reservations, the various techniques that make up their art, and some of the stories connected to the tribe, right here on Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.